Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
And I think it's a good way to introduce it, the way that it's brought in. I think it's a very interesting period. Dare I mention the Dam Busters and say it's a similar sort of period to that. Maybe he's gone, this is the alternative. This is what most of the raids were like at that period. Maybe he's highlighting that as a counterpoint to the Dam Busters.
Welcome to the Damcasters, brought to you in association with the Pima Air and Space Museum. I'm your host, Matt Bone. Following on from last week's discussion with the cast and crew of the Radio 4 adaptation of Len Dyson's Bomber, I felt it was important that we spent a bit of time chatting about Bomber's place in the historiography of the RAF and Bomber Command specifically. And to do this, I'm joined by two fantastic historians. We have Dr. Dan Elin, who is the archivist and historian for the International Bomber Command Center Digital Archive, which is housed at the University of Lincoln. And we have James Jeffries, who's doing his PhD on the RAF in popular culture, and he's finding some fantastic stuff. Now, what we're going to do as fans of the book and the adaptation is talk about some of the themes that it comes up, and we're going to delve into things like lack of moral fiber, on which Dan has done a lot of work. So we're going to be picking Bomber apart a bit to see where it fits in the wider history of Bomber Command and how it should be viewed today, because it is a very 1960s, 1970s book and a very 90s adaptation. So without further ado, we'll dive straight into our conversation. And I'll apologize now, I do talk a bit more in this one than I do usually. Sorry about that. I suppose that let's put Bomber within its context here. So it's Dighton writes it in the late 60s. It comes out, 71 in the States, wasn't it?
Yeah. And then I think paperback was 72 here, I think.
So it sits in an interesting place in the sort of cultural history, isn't it? Because you have that whole... I don't want to say 60s backlash, but there's a very fixed view of Bomber Command at this point. What sort of world is it landing into when Dighton does this? Because it's, you know, he's coming off the spy books by the time he gets onto these, so it's quite a departure for him. But he's tapping into something, isn't he?
I think for me, he's kind of leading the way. It's it's really before the veterans all start publishing their memoirs. There's been a few, but not that many. And it's kind of leading the way of telling the story. I think, I mean, all the veterans are what, mid, late 40s, 50s when this book comes out. So they're sort of starting to sit back and take stock and want to tell the story. But it, even with what comes later, it's way above and beyond anything else that's around at the time. It's I know people said groundbreaking as far as it goes. It's, you know, the research he did for the book, and it's the way that it's put together with the multiple perspectives and the intertwined narratives. That, you know, I mean, the copy, I looked for my copy and I've lent it to some bugger who's not giving me it back, and I had to go out and buy another one. No,
it's not me.
And yeah, it's now it's a Penguin Modern Classic now, so it's an important book, and it's, yeah, the way it tells a story is just hasn't been done before, and I don't think it's been done since to the same extent, really.
I think Len tried to capture that sort of lightning in a bottle again with some of his other Second World War books, but never quite got there, did he, James? What's your take on the book?
Yeah, I mean, it comes out, yeah, at the end of the 60s. You've had by then the sort of public perception of the RAF Bomber Command is now sort of going as that memory of the Dam Busters, and that next generation has discovered them through that film, Fighter Command. You've got the Battle of Britain, 69, the year before. You started as well, you've got things as like Beyond the Fringe, where you've got that sketch where they're doing the Perkins, I wish I could go with you, all that sort of thing. And Monty Python as well, that suddenly there's this comic element, the RAF. It's not quite the glamour that it used to be. It's moved on from the sort of, I don't know, Reach for the Skies, Angels 1-5, as I say, Dam Busters again. It's starting to get a new sort of identity and memory, but also this other generation coming out. And I think the thing, I mean, and Dayton's obviously had his success with the Ypres File and Funeral in Berlin. And yeah, you get the sense that he's written this as, and I don't know whether he said this, but it feels like something he's really wanted to do. And I really credit him for the research he's done. He's gone to Germany, he's talked to people there, and he's decided to take it and tell this story from multiple perspectives, which is quite unusual before and quite unusual since, I think. And the themes and topics that are dealt with there, I mean, we'll talk about LMF later and things like that, I think are, you know, things that aren't really discussed. So you get hints of it in a film like Appointment in London and such like, but this is very much stamped. And are we allowed to give too many spoilers? Are we assuming people haven't
the books? What, 53 years old now. The adaptation we'll get onto in a minute is that's nearly 30. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't, yeah. Well, to be fair, if you listen to last week's episode, it's already been spoiled for you. So, yeah. Spoilers so, galore. Yeah. Go for it.
But yeah, you know, you've got the letters at the end, the two, you know, the one where Lambert's dismissed the duties and such. And the other thing I really like about it is you have a description of what happens to the survivors afterwards in the epilogue. I think that's a really interesting section to have as well. And we'll talk about the adaptation in a bit, but the way that that's sort of handled with Tom Baker's narration is just absolutely
awesome. Yeah, I mean, while we're giving spoilers away, it's the decision to make it a fictitious operation by a fictitious squadron from a station that doesn't exist to a target that doesn't exist on a day that never happened is quite an interesting one. Yeah. But I mean, you know, he's an author. He writes fiction, so it's fair enough, I suppose. It's tricky ground if you're sort of writing historical faction and, you know, telling this story with so much speculation and imagination and storytelling. But it's, you know, I don't know. I mean, if history books are allowed to just concentrate on a descriptive narrative rather than, you know, the academic sources and research and footnotes and things, you know, it's the way to go, I don't think.
I think it's that space he gives him, because, you know, he's very much writing in a time when the survivors of the campaign are still around, and I guess he's buying himself that space to be able to. Let's be fair. It is the worst night possible for that squadron, the Pathfinders, and the German city. It's just a compendium of horrors, isn't it? Like, I suppose that's his point in this, that whereas there's moments of humor, you have a lot of darkness in it, from whether it's the class elements going on in the squadron between Sweet and Lambert. You've got the anti-Semitism with Kosher, the young engineer. Then in Germany, you've got, you know, to be fair, I think the one bit of it that doesn't quite sit well with me is the shoehorned in comedy SS pair that sort of show up to start ripping off the tailor and things. I think that's probably a bit much for what else he has going on, because he doesn't need them there to get Anna Luisa mm-hmm. and Hansel into the basement. But it's not a fun read.
Oh God, no, it's traumatic. And the radio show is equally, you know, I listened to that yesterday or day before, and yeah, it's horrible. I mean, the multiple narratives and multiple perspectives things is really important for both the book and the radio play. But it is kind of like, it is the worst case for both sides of the war. It's, you know, it is, for the Germans, it's Hamburg or Dresden. For the RAF, it's Nuremberg. It's, you know, the suffering on both sides is you know, just incredible as far as the scale goes. Yeah.
So it's the 31st of June, 1943, a Saturday that doesn't exist, or a day, as you said, of a day that doesn't exist. That's an interesting point to put it in, because that's really the ramping up of the strategic bomber campaign that's going to only get more so from then. Do you think he chooses 43 because it's this moment where he can fit in without it having to explain too much? He can have things like Oboe, H2S, where the crews are still complaining about them, have these new tricks and toys, but also have them go wrong. Because if it's much later, you're going to have more than just, I think he has four or five Pathfinder mosquitoes that go wrong, isn't it? So he's giving himself a little bit of breathing room there, that it's early enough that these things can break quite easily, but also late enough that there's going to be, he's able to send, what was it, 700 aircraft up at a time. Do you think he Len chose it, put it in the right period because of what it allowed him to do?
Yes.
And that's the answer. Let's move on to the next question.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, it was a war of the scientists as much as it was the guys flying or on the ground. Yeah. So he could probably have put it any time from the date he chose onwards. And I think that the radio play picked a different date, but it's still 43.
It would have
probably worked in 44 as well, less so perhaps in 45.
Yeah, I mean, I think as well, you've got the, it fits in with the sort of Battle of the Ruhr and the Happy Valley being mentioned a lot in the book, you know, it's Happy Valley again and in the radio adaptation. I think it makes sense, as you say, Matt, to put it there, because it is before you've had the Battle of Berlin and the Nuremberg Raid. It's before sort of, you know, the D-Day. It's before Dresden, but it's after a massive learning curve, so to speak. It's after a huge period of Bomber Command developing and getting used to that technology. And I think it's a good way to introduce it, the way that it's brought in. I think it's a very interesting period. Dare I mention the Dam Busters and say it's a similar sort of period to that. Maybe he's gone, this is the alternative. This is what most of the raids were like at that period. Maybe he's highlighting that to, as a counterpoint to the Dam Busters.
Everybody drinks.
So working with the IBCC Digital Archive, we're not doing so many veteran interviews now for obvious reasons. But when we started the project, we recruited an awful lot of volunteers and trained them to do oral history interviews. Some of them didn't really have, they might have had a background in history, but maybe not so much background or the knowledge about Bomber Command. I used to recommend that they read this novel as, you know, to get a handle on the stories they might be told, so they could understand some of the things, you know, some of the navigation aids and the way things worked and what different crew members might be talking about. So, you know, I found it really useful. And I think the volunteers that we trained up also, you know, it's a great way of introducing the subject.
Similarly, I point to the radio adaptation as well. You know, I say, if you want something, look at this. You know, if you don't really have much of an idea about it and what it was like and what was happening.
Yeah, just, do you give them trigger warnings? And
yes, I do. I'm not that mean. Believe it or not.
It's been weird. When I first started talking to everybody about doing the reunion, and I mentioned it to James, this was February time, and I dusted the book off the shelf and had a read of it. And only, it was over Christmas, I'd reread Goodbye Mickey Mouse. And in my head, the two had kind of conflated a little bit. Yep. And then you read Bomber, and it's an infinitely better novel. But like you say, there isn't a moment in it, nor in the adaptation either, where a punch is pulled. It's always to the point. And, you know, even from when the cookie drops on the armorer, you know, it's the foreshadowing of just how bad that's going to get. Granted, you know where that cookie's going to end up. But it's that thing that just shows, and I think that's a really important point as well, is that accidents happen and things went wrong on station, you know, entire aircraft would blow up, the whole thing, because you're dealing with, you know, weapons of war that are made to be as light and as flimsy as possible to carry as much ordnance as possible. So it wouldn't take much for them to go up. And I think that's interesting that he chooses to do that. But then holds back from the whole thing exploding because he has, you know, the creaking door crew running off saying it's going to go and things like that. It's really him on the top of his game. And I love the what became known as the Harry Palmer books because he doesn't have a name in the first two, does he? In the Ipcress Files, the other one. Go back and check it out, folks. Harry Palmer is named in the movies, not in the book. Now I'm getting two confused looks now. They're both Googling to check me out. But it's just really, really good. But I guess that before we just get on to the adaptation, the reception for it at the time was quite, but it was that weird period that the missing Booker Prize as well, that they then said it was going to be. It says on Wikipedia, that source of all knowledge, that in 2011, they had a lost Booker Prize for 70, and it was on the long list for that. Didn't make the shortlist, which is interesting.
Oh, okay.
And of course, the most important thing, Motorhead named their third album after it. Yeah, so there we go. Thank you, Lemmy. But I guess, you know, because it was a big hit. Let's sort of segue into the adaptation before we start picking it apart a bit. Putnam tried to make it as a film in the 80s, couldn't get the money and ended up doing Memphis Belle. I think it was you telling me, James, that the letters in it are RAF letters in Memphis Belle. Was it you?
Yes. I can't remember where I read that, but yeah. I mean, it's a haunting scene to think of as well, you know, the letters being read to the families and it's incredibly powerful with the real footage being shown. And I think that's another thing actually that Bomber on the radio does is you're cut to a veteran, you're cut to someone underneath the bombs, you'll cut to, you know, someone being interviewed about dropping the bombs. And that just that reminder of that realism is incredibly powerful because you'll be engrossed with the drama and then all of a sudden there'll be this voice. And it's just that reality check that I think is incredibly powerful, which you get with the docudrama very often, you know, with interviews and the drama being played out. Sometimes it's not very good. Sometimes it can be manipulated. But in these cases, I think with Bomber certainly and that scene in Memphis Belle, it's just, it's a really, really powerful
The thing
moment.
That's different with it being a radio adaptation is the listener has to really work. Yeah, it's an active listen. Mm. It's not something that you can put a film on and then play on your phone. If you're going to you know, experience it, you have to concentrate and pay attention, and that means that your imagination is working, and that means that, you know, the scenes are as graphic or as horrific or as real as you can think them, and it's it makes it really powerful.
I said it to the guys in the reunion as well. There's something about hearing Peter Spodden talk in the same way we got so used to hearing RAF American, Canadian, Australian pilots talking about the act of shooting something down. Whereas, but when it cuts to the scene when Esmond Sugar gets shot and it's talking about where each of the shells is going, it's all orange, isn't it? When Flash gets killed in the back, when he's talking about the shell going through the tail gunner, and it cuts to Spodden talking about how he would line up and where he'd put his shells. It's that matter of fact is the wrong phrase, but you know what I mean? That sort of, here was a man who was good at his job explaining how he did his job, exactly the same way we were used to hearing Battle of Britain pilots and Mustang pilots and Jaeger talking about getting his kills. There's something oddly chilling about hearing it in a German accent when it's happening to characters you've just spent, in the case of Bomber, the entire afternoon with. There's something about hearing him talking about doing his job that is really affecting.
But I think that's what Dayton was trying to do with the book as well. I mean, he talks at the end about wanting to write a novel about mechanicalization of war and bringing it back to the human story. Yeah. And you get that. I mean, whoever is telling the story, whichever side the fighter pilot's on, they are attacking the aircraft. They're not thinking about the people at the time. They think about the people later on when they've landed. And, then they start to wonder what their bullets or cannon shells are doing. But it is the way of getting across the horror and the how impersonal the war is. Mm-hmm. Again, the way with the radio and Tom Baker's narration, it goes into slow motion for that scene. You're being told where each individual shell goes and what it does, and the burst is only a matter of seconds, but the listener just sits there spellbound and shocked listening to it and just imagining the horror. It's powerful stuff.
The one thing that always, I know it's cut for time, but the things going wrong for the night fighters as well, the aircraft that crashes into the lake and things, showing how difficult that job was for them as well, because flying at night's bad enough, but flying at night in a underpowered, overloaded JU-88 as well. That's a shame that didn't make that. Go read the book, ladies and gentlemen. That scene is quite something. Where was the first time you guys heard the adaptation?
I seem to remember listening to it with my dad on the day and checking the Radio Times when it was on. But I remember more clearly having it on cassette and listening to it myself. How old was I when it came out? I would have been about 7 or 8. And I think that little bit older when I listened to it on cassette, I took it in more. And I think, I shouldn't really have been listening to it at that age. But you know what it's like. It explains a lot. That little bit older, it really, really sunk in. And actually, I hadn't listened to it for a while until we started speaking about it, Matt. And I thought, I'm gonna dig this up again. It had been a few years. And also with my current writing for my PhD, I'm looking at the Royal Air Force in the Second World War and interpretation since, and especially in the collective memory, public memory. A lot has happened since then. I've done a lot of research and looking at other productions and stuff, and it really, really still stands. It's still incredibly powerful. I think it's, I use the word balance, but just the multiple voices really do something. And it struck me. But when I first watched it, I listened to it. Sorry, I was very young and it's a little bit vague. I don't think I really knew what it was, to be honest. I probably went to bed before it finished. I can't remember. But I remember it being a thing and My dad was into Doctor Who, as was I, and it was a bit like, oh, it's Tom Baker. Wow, you know, he's, what was it, Doctor Who and aircraft. That was what I was nuts about growing up. I was like, oh, the two are almost merged together. But you soon forgot about it. You know, Tom was very, very different in this. And I think read it absolutely wonderfully. And I don't know, not the word deadpan, but it's just so matter of fact, the way that he says some of these things are absolutely horrific when you start thinking and picturing about it. And almost, yeah, just this, yeah, the the power of it is absolutely wonderful. And it really, really helps carry that story. You can't really imagine if you did it as a straight sort of radio play, it wouldn't work. That narration really, really.
What's weird with the narration as well? I mean, we've spoken about spoilers. He does give away sort of hints of what, you know, this will be the last flight of O Orange creaking door. But then, of course, there is a bit of a twist because, you know, you think, uh-oh, but, yeah, some of them do get back. I first heard it. I had to seek it out because I missed it when it went out live. I listened to it. I sought it out when I was doing my master's. And then again, more recently, when I started thinking about the interpretation for the Bomber Command Center, because that's what we've tried to do in the exhibition there. It's telling the stories from both sides of the conflict in the air and on the ground. And, we've done it with a handful of interpretation panels, each with 150 words on, and Dayton got a whole book, and the radio show got, it's 9.5 hours of broadcast time, but with, well, what is it, 3 hours, 40 minutes, if you listen to the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's been really important, I think.
Well, let's start picking it apart a bit. And because there's, you know, having spent now, goodness, in the last week, a lot of time on this, it's been living rent free in my head quite heavily over the bank holiday. My wife asking me what I'm thinking about. It's, for the last few days, it's been this, because it sticks in your head. And like I said earlier, it's very on the nose. And I don't think if it was written today, that would happen. But we're going to get to that later. But let's start looking into the story a bit. And Dan is the chap for this question, really. And I know what his first answer is going to be. But in my questions, I've just written LMF. But then I asked my fantastic Damn Casteers on Patreon if they had any questions. And of course, straight up comes the wonderful Joe Wilding, friend of the show, guest previously. And he writes my questions better than me. So, Dan, really, how did the approach to LMF evolve in the wake of World War II? Because we're seeing in Bomber a very specific view of it. How did the RAF really handle that versus perhaps the perception that Bomber has probably not helped with?
Okay, so yeah, my quick answer is go read my paper, folks, which you can find.
So what do we mean by LMF, in case?
Lack of moral fiber. Yeah. So it's been sort of spun or regarded as a medical term, but it's not a medical term. It was never a medical diagnosis. It was always an executive decision about the ability of an airman to carry on flying and do his operation. So you could volunteer to become air crew. You weren't allowed to say, actually, thanks very much, I've had enough. So it was quite a draconian measure that was used to persuade aircrew to keep flying. And the way they did that was by making the alternative to flying and possibly being killed or injured was deemed to be more horrific than actually being killed or injured. Now, the way it worked mostly was because the rumor of this thing was so powerful. There were three different letters, executive letters, sent round to all station commanders explaining the procedure of what you were meant to do if somebody came to you and said, I don't want to fly anymore. But the letter was interpreted differently by different COs and different people in charge. The CO did have to work quite closely with a medical officer, but again, it was all down to interpretation. And a lot of what happened to somebody who refused to fly was, you know, down to the character of the medical officer and the experience of the medical officer or the CO. What actually happened, in most cases, was the person was removed from the station as quickly as possible because they thought, you know, this would spread, it would catch. Although, again, it's not a medical diagnosis. And it's also not PTSD. I get quite annoyed about that. But what would happen, what was meant to happen was they would be, the person would be removed from the station. They would probably go through some sort of medical examination because if they could find a genuine medical reason, a genuine medical diagnosis why this person couldn't fly, they weren't LMS, they wouldn't go down that route. And they were, you know, if they were found to be LMF, and the numbers are quite low. I've forgotten the facts and figures. Read my article, folks.
The link will be in the description to this
bless you,
this
thank
very
you.
Podcast.
Yeah. They would, you know, if you're an officer, you would lose your rank. If you were a non-commissioned officer, you would be busted down to AC2 and sent elsewhere. The issue I have with the book is there is this sort of pseudo letter from the admin officer at RAF Station Worley Fen, which is a pure work of fiction because it makes it sound like this is, you know, the CEO who has made the decision that this chap is LMF and this is what's going to happen to him. And that's not the case. Everybody was seen by medical professionals, the trick cyclists, the psychiatrists or the neurologists. And towards the end of the war, everyone was interviewed by a chap called Wing Commander James Lawson. The terrifying rumor that went round that proved so effective is that these chaps would be paraded in front of the entire squadron and their badges of rank and their brevet, their wings would be ripped off and they'd be marched away in disgrace. I think it did happen, but it happened on very few stations and it's due to the CEO deciding that was what was going to happen. But I've also read accounts where someone had spent months being sent from pillar to post and going through lots of different surveys and interviews and medical, you know, diagnostic checks to see what was up with him. And after they had decided, a panel with three senior officers, that he was LMF, he was quietly asked to give his stripes and his wing in. So, you know, there wasn't the humiliating parade as far as he was concerned. And also, it did become slightly more lenient as the war went on. And certainly someone like Lambert in the book and in the radio play, what was he, 48 ops he'd done? Mm-hmm. They couldn't have done that to him. You know, there's an interesting class element in the history of LMF, and there's an interesting class element in the book. I mean, going back to when I did history and English lit combined as an undergrad, and the first thing you think of when you read a new novel is this about class, race, or gender? And this one is very much about class. It's throughout the whole book. And as far as LMF goes, because of the, you know, the culture at the time, it's a bit like the First World War. If you're an officer who couldn't take it anymore, you had anxiety. If you're and other ranks, if you're a private, it was hysteria. There's this sort of feminine aspect to it. And with the RAF, it was thought the lack of moral fibre more affected the sergeant air crew and also the different trades. So it shouldn't happen to a navigator or a pilot because, you know, they were cut above your wireless operators, air gunners and flight engineers. And so there's this whole element of class goes throughout it. Have I answered the question?
No, I'm just happy listening to you because it's having read your paper before delving into this pair of things. It's fascinating and harrowing, and it makes more sense than what happens to Lambert in this. Because this is the second time he brings in this particular book. It's the second time he brings back an aircraft with most of his crew dead. You know, it's not. You know, he has shown that is not the case for him. And I think maybe Dighton's doesn't play that inner turmoil of Lambert well enough. Like I said, it comes across a bit flat, but it is there, and it feels very late 60s description of it. And I don't know whether that's right, but it feels like that whole lions led by donkeys sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it plays in the book and the radio show that, yeah, look what these terrible toffs did to this working class hero. And that's kind of doesn't sit with me. I throwing that out as an open question, really, if it is just me, tell me. But I think that's how I've always read it and listened to it. And I just think it doesn't quite feel right.
I think you're right. And I think it's even obvious to the point that you've got that, he won't play cricket. You know, it's that on the nose, actually, that, I'm the same. It's one thing that does jar me, listening to it.
Yes, because that's the whole bit in the book as well about the upcoming cricket match, isn't it? As well, which, yeah. Thankfully, yeah. Joe Dunlop cut out of the radio show because that doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah.
It's a great narrative. It's a great hook. It drags people in because, you know, they do get, you know, it's annoying and you get upset that such a thing could happen to somebody. So I can understand why it's in the book. It's, you know, it's another way of making them seem to be victims. I mean, Sweet is the bad guy in the book. We've got these multiple narratives where people empathize and associate and can feel, you know, what's going on from all sorts of different perspectives. But I mean, okay, you also do feel for Sweet a bit, but it's, you know, he is the sort of mustache twirling villain in this piece, isn't he? So it's really quite interesting because, you know, the book sort of sets out what Dayton had been told by some veterans in the late 60s when he was doing his research. And then, you know, from my experience working with volunteers and veterans and recording interviews with them, because memory is so tricky and complicated, and you're recording oral histories of people years, decades after the events, everything that they have seen, read, heard, watched becomes an influence on their story. And particularly, I think with Black and Moral Fibre, the story that's set out in this book then sort of confirms the rumours that were going around actually during the war itself, and it becomes, you know, more set in stone that this is the narrative, this is what happened. I'm glad that he actually did it the way he did, and, you know, didn't mention that the parade that is mentioned in by other people. It's always when veterans do talk about it, it's always something that happened to somebody else on another squadron and they didn't see it, but this is what happened, folks. And I think part of the idea of what happened, the procedure, comes from things like this book.
We're going to take a quick break so that we can get the latest from the Pima Air and Space Museum with Head of Collections, Andrew Bowley.
Here we are at the Pima Air and Space Museum among our collection of kamikaze aircraft. We have two versions of the Oka, which was a suicide rocket-powered human-guided bomb. This version here is the two-seat trainer version. We made a couple of them that were launched on a catapult with one rocket engine that they would use to train potential Oka pilots. We have the instructor in the back and the student up front. It technically could glide and they could land it back on the skid and, you know, learn how to fly the operational version of the aircraft. It also had a longer wingspan to allow it to perform as a glider. The operational Oka right over here, which is on loan from the Royal Air Force Museum. The trainer version is actually on loan from the National Air and Space Museum. The operational Oka was an anti-shipping human-guided suicide bomb. It would be loaded underneath a Japanese G4M Betty bomber. It would be launched, had three rockets in the back, if I recall correctly, and really only had about less than a minute, only maybe about, it was about 20 or 30 seconds worth of actual flight time. And then it would kind of go into a terminal dive on a ship guided by the suicide or kamikaze pilot flying the aircraft. They weren't all that successful, not because of the design itself. The biggest problem being the fact that they were strapped on a Japanese Betty. They had to get within about 20 miles of the American fleet, which meant most of them were shot down while still strapped on the Japanese bomber. But they did have a few successes off of Okinawa. So the aircraft behind it is a Nakajima Ki-115 Tsurugi, which is another purpose-built kamikaze aircraft. During the war, the majority of kamikaze aircraft leading up to, you know, the end of the war were mostly repurposed aircraft, so Zeros, Oscars, Bettys, Bells, etc. With the Tsurugi, the Japanese Army Air Service was building an aircraft specifically designed from bottom up as a one-way mission kamikaze suicide special attack force aircraft. The wings are made out of aluminum. The fuselage is essentially made out of metal that's no different than you'd have in air ducting. That's why it's kind of rusted. The inside of the cockpit is all very rudimentary with, like, wood control stick and throttle, maybe 3 or 4 gauges at best. The landing gear actually dropped off the aircraft so that they could repurpose them. Also, you know, it kind of forced, I will say it probably also forced the Japanese pilot onto his, to complete his mission or attempt to complete his mission. So once you drop the landing gear, the explosive or bomb that's armed underneath your aircraft, you're not exactly going to be able to belly land that aircraft without destroying yourself in the aircraft. But this was kind of shows just like how desperate the Japanese were getting at the end of the war, just making these mass-produced, kind of like simple-built aircraft, just so they could have the sheer numbers for them for the what they expected to be the decisive invasion of Japan with the first in Kyushu and then Honshu. But because of the dropping of the atomic bombs in Hirohito, realizing that they could not go on any longer, that they decided to surrender to the United States, and the Allies, I should say.
To learn more about what is on display and what events are coming up at the Pima Air and Space Museum in Tucson, Arizona, please do check out their website at www.pimaair.org.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And now, back to the show. It's one of those areas that I think, you know, with your paper and things that we definitely need to talk about more, because it has become a trope. You know, very much of, you look at, as you're saying, you look at the First World War and you have, you know, Sassoon up on this pedestal and the poets and, you know, Olaf at Craig Lockhart getting carefully looked after. And you know, to be fair, Pat Barker's Regeneration does that quite well, showing the difference between the care for the officers and the electroshock treatment for the enlisted men. It's a similar sort of thing here. Sure. And it's, again, that's, you know, as you're saying, that book's straight up and down about class, because you've even got the officer up from the ranks. In Bomber, you've got Lambert's wife trying to convince him to take a commission and he won't do it and things. And
yeah.
Because the other thing, Lambert, of course, is an old hand. He's a 37 volunteer, isn't he? So that's the other part of his story, is that he's a lifer. He's proper RAF. He's not. Sorry, Dan, I spoke.
Oh no, I was just going back to my research. There's a chap who was a flight engineer who saw his mate, the bomb aimer, brutally killed right in front of him, and he froze and couldn't do anything. I think he was, you know, screaming and running up and down when they landed. And, you know, he was taken off and they sent him to Matlock, which was the hospital for NCOs. He never went down the Lacamoral fibre route. He had a medical diagnosis and he received electroconvulsive therapy for his problems as well. So.
Let's switch things up a bit and go from traumas of the mind to traumas of high explosives falling on you. The German side of things, I'm going to say something controversial here. I think the Kriegfeld, now that I'm bringing it up, he's quickly looking at the name of Altgarden. There you go. Because Kriegfeld's the target that they miss. I actually think that's the better section of the book. And I feel that way because it's a story that we don't get to read or hear very often. Yeah. I'm going to throw this one to you, James, in your looking at the war in public media. In all of your sort of research around the RAF on film, how much of it actually looks at the other side of the coin, even say in the last 30 years?
Very, very little. I mean, you're seeing an influence because you get European films that have and do this. But in terms of a British popular sort of memory of it, it is an unseen event. It is an unseen thing generally that happens. I mean, yeah, you think about what's happening, the films of the 50s, you've got Appointment in London, you've got the German perspective from the defences, but you don't see what's happening on the ground. Dambusters, you just see a few people running away from some flooding water. And yeah, you go on from that, you get TV productions like Bomber Harris. Again, it is in that room, it is Bomber Command headquarters. There's quite a lot, really. Yeah, you just don't get it. I mean, you had the film, I forgot what it's called now, The Bombardment on Netflix, that showed collateral damage, but it was Denmark. It wasn't Germany again. You have things like The Book Thief, where you have bombing raids in it and such like. But again, it's a European influence. It's not a British perspective. There is this reluctance, really, to go look at what was happening on the ground. So that's one thing that I think I really like about Bomber, is that it is this chance to do this. And it is. And I think, yeah, that the scenes are played really, really interestingly. You do have themes like the myth of the clean Luftwaffe that's mentioned, you know, I think that's a very interesting area that's brought into it. So on that and other basis, I think, it covers a lot of ground that you don't normally see in these sort of productions. I think you do see it in documentaries and you see it in some quite sensationalized documentaries.
We're not mentioning the Canadian sensationalized documentary on this podcast.
No.
So don't even think about bringing that up.
the other thing with it is when it's the radio adaptations made, it's obviously in February 95, 50 years after Dresden, almost to the day, and Bomber Harris is repeated on TV at the same time, originally shown 3rd of September 1989. Is repeated together, and obviously that's got quite a heavy focus on Dresden, and you've had documentaries that are focused on it as well. So I don't think it's any coincidence, really, that, you know, the scheduling was like that, and the fact that it's moved to February, was that intentional? Was that just when the production got kicking and it was broadcast? I don't know. That's something that I would have liked to have asked.
See, if you were there or
found out that, yeah. I know. here we go. But, you know, it that as well keeps that and probably reinforces the, I won't mention the film because we're not sipping our drinks, and also Dresden. That seems to be the two prolonged memories when it comes, or popular memories of Bomber Command seem to be those two. You know, it's... I think that's reinforced a little bit, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think in this country, the popular memory of Dresden, it's easy for people to kind of excuse it as a one-off, and, you know, oh, it was particularly dry and there was that wind blowing. But It's uncomfortable, but that is what Bomber Command were trying to do every time they took off. That's why they had the mix of bomb load and incendiaries that they always had. That, you know, that was what they were aiming to do. And it's not pleasant thinking about that. And the book and the radio make that abundantly clear.
Yeah, and raids like Hamburg and Cologne and Lübeck and, you know, all the, we don't talk about those. But I suppose with the Dresden thing, you've got the politics, you've got the moment that Churchill starts shunning and there starts to be these conversations and this change in memory. That adds to it as well. And of course, post-war, what happens with the Soviet Union and historians and Nazi figures being used and everything, you know, that amplifies that raid and that memory even more.
It came up again today. There's the Slaughterhouse Five aspect as well.
Yeah. And so it goes.
Yes. Yeah. And I feel for Vonnegut because he was trying to work out a lot of trauma, which was why he clung to the big numbers of people like Irvin and the Soviet propaganda. I can understand that, but the fact that Slaughterhouse Five is then held up as an accurate depiction of it, I think it's a shame. It doesn't do Slaughterhouse Five justice for what that book is actually about. Sleeping with aliens, I think it's what it's about.
Time travel.
Yeah. But it's those interesting things. And I think how Deighton and then the guys that did the adaptation as well worked those Altgard scenes in was it is every time you cut to it, it's a bit of a gut punch because you have the party, you have the literally doomed love affair between the radar operator and Anna Luisa. Poor Anna Luisa, she was a bit of a goer.
Like I say, it's race, class, or gender. There you go.
There, yeah. But it's going to happen as soon as it starts. And I think where the genius of that raid sequence is that it's just the first wave. You go through all of that, and then the Burgermeister's handed the bit of paper saying there's another wave coming. There's another 400 bombers, and the second aspect of it is covered in a few pages, and I think in about 20 seconds of Tom Baker's narration as well, just sort of shows that these were very carefully orchestrated things. You know, as Dan, you'd probably be able to say better. And as you said before, these things were designed to cause mass damage and they weren't a constant stream of things. They would stop and start and move and generally just get worse.
Yeah, it was scientifically worked out and the timings were worked out and they'd sent different waves in from different directions because they knew that the air crew would creep back and they would set the target markers down so they would cover the target areas as best they could. I mean, again, with does it matter that the whole Altgarden is bombed because it was an accident? It's part of the fog of war. It's part of the horrors of war. I mean, again, with spoilers, I think it's quite a nice little touch that the two chaps are killed on a motorcycle at the end of the book because, there's a lot of that as well that just, people don't think about. So
There's little touches throughout it as well. There's Mickey Martin getting killed on the ground by the rescue workers. There's little moments of almost incidental horror that gets worked into the book. And I think, it's the Mickey Martin scene has always stuck with me because he's sort of thinking he's about to be taken prisoner. And of course, those guys have just been trying to put the fire out at the hospital, which is another terrible scene. It's a horror movie and a horror book. All these,
I've written that down. There's Stephen King and there's this. And
just sort of on that. Yeah. Do we have figures for aircrew? I guess we could call it lynched after they jumped out, or is it just something that's imponderable?
I think it's one of those things we'll never know. I mean, I could talk to the losses archivist. I know he's looking into it, but I've not got any numbers to hand at the moment.
All right, that wasn't a prepared question, so I won't hold you to it.
I'm sure I found a figure in the hundreds, but again, it's difficult to pinpoint, and I remember not finding an exact one. It was just the one that seemed to add up for me, but I didn't go into any major detail or research over it. I was curious myself, actually, to find out. I actually think that scene, I don't want to use the word is my favourite, but it's the one that I really got a shiver up my spine listening to it, because they have returned from the hospital, it's being bombed. It's actually two enemies coming face to face that, in a different circumstance, he'd be bundled off to a POW camp, or if there wasn't a war, you know, they'd be drinking beer together in a pub. It just, for me, just puts so many thoughts into my head. And I actually had to pause it, you know, when I listened to it recently, just to try and soak it in and think about what was being
said. It makes
said
it personal, doesn't it? So much of it is impersonal, because you're dropping bombs on people from so many thousand feet, or you're opening fire from so many hundred yards. But that, it brings the human side back into it, doesn't it?
And it's that it also leaves things up to the imagination, which is the incredible thing really about the radio production and books in general as well. But the fact is, it ends on the just let's go and get the axes or whatever they say. You know, there's no description. It's your imagination there that's going, okay, we know what's going to happen. Yeah. And I think that's a really clever piece of writing, and a very, very, very powerful piece of writing as well.
I've kind of said it's all on the nose, and it's a very carefully designed book to pile horror upon. You know, as you said, Dad, it's Stephen King, and then there's this. I guess putting the historian's hat on, how
he's looking for his historian's hat.
Yeah.
I'm trying to see if I got a hat nearby.
I think you get it when you get to your vibe.
I've got a dolphin mask.
Let's put the tin hat on there.
Let's put the tin hat on here.
I can't reach it.
I suppose my question is, that's all staying in the edit, boys. I'm sorry.
that's the black humour that you need when you've been discussing this sort of stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the people that we interview. They'll tell you a story like this. It could be out of the book or from the radio thing, and then they'll tell you a joke.
Yeah. I guess my question really is, does this sit well in the history of Bomber Command? Is it too on the nose to do the strategic bombing campaign justice? Because it is something that has lived very long. For something that doesn't get repeated very often, I think it's only been on 4 Extra a few times and on the main channel once or twice. But it's something I've mentioned that we've been doing this, and it immediately gets people talking and going, oh, I remember that. Yeah, I think we've covered that it's probably not the most accurate, and it's horror upon horror strung together for effect. But has this had an outsized influence on how we think of Bomber Command?
I don't think in the big picture it probably has. I think other things will come to public mind first, which I think is a tremendous shame, because I think when it comes to the strategic bombing campaign and bombing in the Second World War, actually, let's broaden this out, is an incredibly complex and long story where it comes from. You've got to look at the First World War. You've got to look at the bomber as a deterrent in the interwar years, the fear that comes with it, and the start of the war, where there is the scale of it is so much less. And there are, you know, you do have the bombers in daylight going to attack Kriegsmarine German naval ports and making sure that they drop the bombs flying away from the coast so that they don't risk killing, you know, to escalate into Hamburg, to escalate into the firebombing of Tokyo, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there is a massive story here to comprehend, understand, which in the nicest sense is not going to be learnt very quickly. And most people won't be aware of that when it comes to this story. I think though, that what you can do and what Bomber does incredibly well is say that this is horrific, and it's horrific for a lot of people in different ways. And it's not drop our bombs, let's go home for tea and medals, which I'm not a fan of. I get that it was a thing, and I get that it would have been a tool in propaganda during the war, but to still have that as a narrative, I think, is dangerous and frankly quite disrespectful to a lot of people. But that's what I think. I think Bomber, that realism, yeah, it is on the nose, but it was pretty awful.
I think that if as many people were aware of the book and the radio play as are aware of the Dam Busters film and, to lesser extent, Rickles' book. Yeah, cheers, folks. I think we would have a much more rounded understanding of the bombing war. I mean, it's a brilliant way in if you don't know anything about it, and it does make you ask more questions, and hopefully sends you down, you know, the rabbit warren of doing more research for yourself. It doesn't talk about the historical debate. It doesn't talk about was the strategy the right one. It doesn't talk about it. It doesn't even talk about the ethics or morals of it. It's basically reporting this is, you know, kind of what went on and the horrors of it. But it's also you can read some books that have come later, and even some veteran memoirs, and it tends to be this happened and then this happened and this happened and then this happened, the end. And it's not a boring, narrow-minded one sort of perspective description, or it does go into depth, and you have got these intertwined narratives, and it really makes the reader or the listener think. So yeah, I think it's important in the memory of Bomber Command, and I would like it to be more well known. Yeah,
you can see why they made Memphis Belle.
Well, they wanted a very young Dan Elling to be an extra in it. That's the only reason they made that film. Had to have a haircut and everything.
I remember reading that. That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what Memphis Belle does, though, isn't it? Really, there's no real thought about the people on the ground. The guys in the bomber are the victims, and everything is against them getting back. Whereas this is more balanced.
Yeah, and they go around again, don't they? Because they don't want to risk bombing the school.
Yes, but then you still don't see what, you know.
What they, you very much doubt that they all landed.
You'll get me onto my precision rant if you start talking about that.
Which is wonderful, because the book or the radio program don't even go there. It's just, this is what we're doing, chaps. Here's the briefing. This is the target. Yeah. I mean, he does ask the question, doesn't he? What is it that we're hitting? And that's, that's bad form. That's bad show. It obviously means that he's a bit bulgy, and he's probably, it's not wavering, they say is, but it's along those lines, isn't it?
Windy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
I think you're right. The fact that it is as matter of fact as it is to its credit. I've just read one book for author I'm going to into, and there's a couple lines in it where there's the classic writerly, this was before the moral conundrums of the later parts of the bombing campaign. And that makes me a bit cross, because it's a get out for not understanding more of it, which, I think the moral debate is an interesting one. And I think it's one that is one of those sort of debating society sort of things that can get a little bit out of hand. But like you're saying, James, as well, and Dan, that long march to the Wonder Area weapon, one bomb, one sissy, you know, that, it is kind of a straight line when you start seeing all the problems that they're trying to figure out to get to that point where they would have what they dreamt of in the 30s. I don't see it as a compromise. I see it as the devil's problem solving, isn't it? It's, how the hell do we do this? It's not a terribly uplifting chat, this one, is it? It's...
No, I'm with you. It's been in my head for since we spoke. It was Friday, wasn't it? Thanks.
It has been a pleasure to go back and spend time with it, because it's one of those things that you kind of think maybe there's an opportunity there for somebody to do it again and take another take on the material. I think some of our recent documentaries about this sort of thing have had moments. I'm not going to name any names, but they tend to still be tech worshipy of the aircraft rather than the important bit, which is the people that are in it. And I think that kind of has let things down. But it's we seem to be in a place where we're glorifying the technology and the, you know, the this mad craze for flying around in the back of Spitfires and things like that, that seems to be missing some of the wider narratives that that we could get to. But not that, I'd turn down sitting in the back of the Canadian Lancaster if there's a seat going and someone wants to fly me to Hamilton. I'd do that in a shot. But
yeah, it's fun. You should try it.
Oh, I see.
Yes. I knew that was going to happen at some point.
To be fair, I had to sign a piece of paper saying that if I die during this flight, it's not my, it's not your fault. It's okay. And I was frightened and no one was shooting at me.
I think my last point is, I remember when it was over, was it that 2014? I was down at Goodwood for the Festival of Speed and Vera and the BBMF flank came over. And yes, they were at low level. Everything was shaking. And it was listening to this, I think the thing that the radio show did so well was the soundscape. Just that constant noise as well, which even, even to the, I was just thinking of James Scott's book about the firestormers in Tokyo as well, where the survivors would talk about just the rush of the air plus the noise of the engines of the low-level bombers as well. That must have been terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing that all the films get wrong with the Foley, isn't it? Because you don't hear you don't hear anti-aircraft fire if you're in a Lancaster, but you have to have it in. The radio thing, I think some of the minor strings are a little bit intrusive. I think they would probably change that if they did that now. And we've spoken about Tom Baker's wonderful narrative. I think a modern audience has to get, well, not so much modern because that's quite old now, but you have to get past Tom Baker on Little Britain being the narrative voice on that a little bit. But again, I don't think he would have got that gig if he hadn't had this one.
Yeah. It's funny because they said they wanted James Naughty for it, which I think would work. It would be different. But there's something about the way
and who was it that played Harris?
Frank
Windsor. Because I thought his voice was spot on for that. Probably better than Max Wall, James.
Right, we're waffling now, gents. Final thoughts. James, what would you like to say to wrap up?
Gosh, if you haven't read the book or listened to the radio production, we've probably ruined it for you with the plot. We haven't. No, go out and listen to it, read it. I think it's, if you haven't, I think it's brilliant. It's not without faults. There are things that could be different. And I'd be very interested to see if it was made now, what it would be like and whether it would. Yeah, I don't think it would be a radio production. I think it would definitely be on screen. I think it'd be very interesting to think about what it would be like. Just go out there and experience it if you haven't.
I can't say anything more than that. Give it a listen, give it a read. Don't expect the sort of traditional, comfortable hurrah for the RAF and back in time for tea and medals, folks. We have given some spoilers. The thing you've got to do is try and guess who makes it and who doesn't.
I specifically did not want to talk about what happens on Orange because it's horrible. But there we go. What might be fun is have this conversation again post Masters of the Air.
So
if you chaps are up for it, let's reconvene because I have a sneaking suspicion that's going to be a bit Memphis Belly.
Yeah, to quote George Harrison, I would be quite prepared for that eventuality.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I cannot thank Dan and James enough for joining me on the podcast. That was a lot of fun. James tried desperately hard to be able to join us for the main reunion, but him being stuck in traffic has meant we've been able to have a proper discussion with Dan about this. And I think it's all turned out for the best, even though he's still upset he missed out. As always, the links will be populated with some fantastic stuff in the description. Most of all is Dan's paper on lack of moral fiber. I highly encourage everyone to have a look at that because it really does bring a lot of light to a subject that, as we've talked about over the last couple of weeks, needs that light to be shed upon it. Their social media links are going to be in the description below. Do give them both a follow because they are fab and they share some incredible stuff as well. And as you've heard, they're both thoroughly decent chaps. As always, thank you so much for listening, supporting the pod. You are all ace. If you can, stick some stars into your podcast app of choice, leave a review, let me know how I'm doing. We can make changes. Everything's up in the air. Go for it. Feel free. Of course, if you fancy joining us on Patreon, you get all of these episodes early, £3 a month, and we have some fun over there as well. And as you heard, sometimes we even let you ask questions, even when they're better than the ones I prepare. There we go. Of course, we can't wrap up an episode without thanking the fantastic team at the Pima Air and Space Museum for the continued sponsorship of the podcast. Their links are always in the descriptions. Check them out. They've got some fun stuff coming up over the summer. If you're in the area, you cannot miss it. It's a fantastic place to go to geek out about planes and do so much more than that. So until next time, thank you so much for listening and do take care of yourselves. The Damcasters is hosted and produced by Matt Bowe and is a Bonya Broad podcast production. To learn more about our podcast and check out our previous episodes, head to www.thedamcasterspod.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.